Civil rights education tends to focus on the past, but if recent events have taught us anything, it's that the work of the civil rights movement isn't finished. This hour, the challenges of teaching about civil rights. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Throughout the month of July, Iowa State University's online course, Teaching and Learning Iowa History, Iowans and the Civil Rights Movement, is exploring civil rights in the state, past and present. Today, we'll talk about how civil rights is taught in schools and how teachers and others can understand the movement better in light of current events. I'll talk with Janice View, co-editor of the book Putting the Movement Back into Civil Rights Teaching, Katie Swalwell of Iowa State University, and Petra Lang of Drake. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. For the second summer in a row, Iowa State University's College of Education has been offering an online course for teachers and others called Teaching and Learning Iowa History, Iowans and the Civil Rights Movement. This summer, the course is focused on Iowans and the struggles against anti-Black racism. And an event on Friday at the African American Museum in Cedar Rapids gives more Iowans a chance to be a part of an important conversation about how issues related to modern-day racial segregation and about how the history of the civil rights movement is taught in schools. You can find out more about that event on our Facebook page or on our Twitter feed at IPR Talk. And we're going to focus this hour on the question about how we teach about the civil rights movement in our schools. And with me to start off is Katie Swalwell, Assistant Professor of Education at Iowa State University, and the woman behind this online course. Hello, Katie.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Great. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
So the course this summer is very similar to the one last summer that we've talked about extensively on this program. But for people who weren't part of that conversation, give me an overview of what this is.
Sure. So the class is an online self-paced class that's open to the general public for free. Teachers can take it for licensure renewal credits, and university students can take it for course credits. And really the idea was to look at Iowa history, which I know you've talked about before, is really a sort of an under-celebrated, under-taught piece of content in the state, and to really look at specifically histories even within that haven't been taught enough. So last summer we decided to really focus on looking at the civil rights movement, and this summer we got even more specific to look at struggles against anti-Black racism in the state. I think it's something that people are genuinely really curious about, kind of blown away by the stories and information that are part of the class, really trying to help us understand the nature of our state today, the current state of affairs, trying to make sense of the present, and really trying to inform our actions and what we support in the present by understanding what happened in the past.
There have been a number of really remarkable people and remarkable things that have happened in history in Iowa with regards to the civil rights movement and with regards to struggles against racism. But I think in the state, we do like to focus on the progressive stories.
Right.
And in digging into Iowa's history, do you think it's important to make sure that we look at some stories that maybe aren't as much fun to remember?
Yeah, I absolutely do. There really are some amazing, incredible stories that people love to celebrate, whether it's the story of Alexander Clark, the activism of Edna Griffin, some really incredible stories. But I do think it's important to situate them in a larger context. So one of the stories I like to start off telling students about, and really telling any audience about, is that when during the Civil War, before the Civil War, when Iowa was entering the Union as a state, it came into the Union as a free state. And so I had really learned, you know, the free states were the good guys and the southern states were the bad guys. And so, you know, there's this idea that we were a welcoming, hospitable state for everyone. And one of the very first things we talk about in the class is that when the state entered the Union, one of the very first debates in the Constitutional Convention, the first legislature meeting, was how we could, in the state, build in mechanisms that would discourage Black settlement in Iowa. So they weren't going to have slavery, but they also didn't want to have Black settlement. And they looked to other northern states that had put in place what's called Black codes. So all sorts of rules like rules against interracial marriage, rules barring black people from serving on juries, attending public school, keeping black people from paying taxes in order to justify not giving them access to public services, requiring them to register and prove that they were free people and make a deposit of $500, which in today's money is thousands of dollars. So when that's really the start of the state as a political entity in the United States, I think that's an important grounding of what people were sort of up against and the ways that the state had really worked to make sure that a certain population would be here over another. So really very explicitly trying to figure out how to discourage black settlement or to make sure that the people who were here were a certain, you know, type of people and behaving in a particular way. So once you start with stories like that and really try to pay attention to the ways that those efforts were underway for decades and decades and decades, some of those successes are seen in a different light. Another quick example is the Iowa Civil Rights Act in the late 19th century was one of the first civil rights acts in the country, which is a great thing to celebrate until you realize that it wasn't actually enforced for another 70 years. So it took, again, decades of struggle to make sure that even the laws on the books were actually adhered to and followed through with. So I think it's just a more comprehensive understanding of the history and the stories, and it actually makes the stories that are fun to celebrate even more powerful and even more inspiring.
Now, of course, you're focusing on history. This is something that we don't necessarily know enough about in the state of Iowa. Mm-hmm. But this event that you've organized on Friday at the African American History Museum of Iowa in mm-hmm. Cedar Rapids connects history to present day as well. Why is that important to you?
Yeah, I mean, as an educator, I see this playing out in schools all the time, and whether it's the curriculum or the demographics of schools, the demographics of who's becoming teachers, I think when we learn about history, it really should be more than just sort of interesting facts that are good for trivia night. You know, we really should be learning history in order to understand what's happening in the present to inform our actions today. So when we look around, one of the speakers at the event is Nicole Hannah-Jones, who's a New York Times Magazine journalist. She just won a Peabody Award. She's actually originally from Waterloo, and she's coming back to Iowa for the first time to speak about her investigative journalism, which is looking at the resegregation of public schools, that schools are actually now more segregated than they were before Brown versus Board by race. So she's really investigating what is happening. How can this be? What's helping this happen? So really, there's no way to learn this history and to not then think about, well, so what's happening now? What has gotten better? What hasn't gotten better? What victories have sort of been eroded in many ways? There's really no other way to look at it. So I'm hoping that community members and especially educators who are in the area can join us on Friday, because I think it's going to be a really great conversation, a great dialogue, and really thinking about what schools, the role that schools play in trying to make sure that future generations really have a deep understanding of this history, especially in districts where there is a lot of self-segregation, that these are things that teachers feel prepared to teach about and feel really comfortable teaching about.
And this is a perfect opportunity to bring in our next guest. I'm talking with Katie Swalwell, Assistant Professor of Education at Iowa State University. And joining us now is Janice View. She's an Associate Professor of Education and Transformative Teaching at George Mason University. She's also the co-editor of Putting the Movement Back into Civil Rights Teaching. A new edition of that book is going to be coming out in January. She will also be speaking at the event on Friday. Hello, Janice.
Hello. It's good to hear your voice, and it's very good to hear Katie's voice. We miss her.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And in talking to Katie about connecting the threads of history to present day, that's something that you have worked a great deal on in how we teach about the civil rights movement in schools. I mean, first of all, what do you think has been, and this is a very big question, but what has been lacking with the kinds of curriculum that have been built around the civil rights movement from your perspective?
Well, let's start first with the way all histories are taught in this country. We are notoriously bad about focusing on the great man, usually the great white man, usually the great dead white man. We also teach about wars and sort of facts and dates. We don't teach history in a way that will engage kids necessarily. And so kids always want to know what the adults are talking about. They always want to know what the scandals are. That's the thing that's really juicy and interesting and intriguing for kids. And so when you start by teaching history from the perspective of, well, what are the unsettled questions that we're still grappling with right now? And Katie referenced some of those in terms of sort of how we understand the presence of African Americans in Iowa or any other part of the country. You know, those questions still live for us. And so when you approach history from that approach, then it's really juicy and exciting for kids, right? And you sort of lead them to ask, well, why are we still debating this? And what does this mean for who you are right now and how people got to this place, et cetera? So that's sort of a broad answer to the teaching of history. The teaching of the civil rights movement typically starts with 1954 with the Supreme Court decision in the Brown v. Board of Education, desegregating schools. And it ends with the assassination of Dr. King in 1968. So those are the bookends that show up in many textbooks and are very conveniently, you know, sort of patched into the King holiday celebration, moving into Black History Month, and then we're done. And so in the book, Putting the Movement Back into Civil Rights Teaching, we're very clear about the fact that, at least on this soil, the civil rights movement began somewhere around 1492, right, with European contact with indigenous people, and that it continues on until today. So first of all, the bookends, there are no bookends. It's sort of infinite when you talk about the nature of human rights struggles, the nature of people having dignity in their economy, their politics, their social lives, et cetera. That's the first thing. But if you are going to use those bookends, then it's not just a Southern struggle. So you've got people in Iowa who are doing things prior to those dates, right? You have people in other parts of the country that were struggling for a lot of these same kinds of issues. So the dates expand, the geography expands, and then the population of people who are concerned about these issues. And so occasionally there will be reference to the white martyrs of, quote, the modern civil rights movement, the Mickey Schwerners and so forth. But there were also indigenous people. There were also Latinas. There were also Asian and Pacific Island people who were part of what we call the civil rights movement, right? Well, I said whites, Asians, African-Americans, Latinas. I think I covered everybody. So the population was broader, the time span was broader, the geography was broader. That's sort of the beginning of the conversation in the book that we're putting forward, that was first published in 2004. And then from there, there's spinoffs.
And we're going to have to take a short break right now, but we'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Janice View. She is an associate professor of education at George Mason University. She's co-editor of the book, Putting the Movement Back into Civil Rights Teaching. And a new edition of that book is coming out in January. Also with me, Katie Swalwell, assistant professor of education at Iowa State University. And coming up on Friday, there's an opportunity for the public to get involved in these conversations at the African American History Museum of Iowa in Cedar Rapids. You can find out more about that event on our Twitter feed at IPR Talk or on our Facebook page. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the challenges of teaching about the civil rights movement and connecting the dots between history and what's going on in the United States today. With me this hour is Katie Swalwell. She is assistant professor of education at Iowa State University, and she's been teaching an online course this summer, continues to teach an online course this summer called Teaching and Learning Iowa History, Iowans and the Civil Rights Movement. It's been focusing on Iowans and the struggles against anti-Black racism this summer. There's a big event coming up on Friday to give other members of the public to an opportunity to be a part of this conversation at the African American History Museum of Iowa in Cedar Rapids. You can find out more about that event on our Facebook page and also on our Twitter feed at IPR Talk. And one of the people who's going to be speaking at the event is also here with us, Janice View, Associate Professor of Education at George Mason University. She's also co-editor of Putting the Movement Back into Civil Rights Teaching, first published in 2004, but there's a new edition coming out in January. And Janice, just before the break, we were talking about the oversimplification of how we teach the civil rights movement in terms mm-hmm. of time period. We kind of put a bookend, 1954 through 1968, and you're saying that this is a subject that goes throughout the history of exploration and settlement in mm-hmm. the United States and up through mm-hmm. present day. You also touched a little bit, you touched on the fact that we oversimplify who was involved and is involved in the civil rights movement by making this a white and black issue. Mm-hmm. But we also tend to oversimplify the figures involved in the civil rights movement as well. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Absolutely. So one of the things that I often say when I do this work, especially with teachers, is that the way we tend to do it is almost like one of those old-fashioned movie posters where you've got Dr. King as the hero swooping in to save the damsel in distress, Rosa Parks, and then you've got Malcolm X as the evil twin in the background, right? And that's the extent of the iconography, if you will, of the civil rights movement. And again, as I said earlier, it's kind of convenient. You've got the Dr. King holiday that happens in January. You move into February, and with elementary school kids especially, you sort of replay the bus boycott, and you've got Rosa Parks, and then you're kind of done. And so while those are all wonderful people and events in history to explore, another thing that happens, for example, when you take kids to the Civil Rights Museum in Memphis at the Lorraine Motel, and they have the room preserved in the way it was before Dr. King was assassinated, one of the first things that kids say, especially middle schoolers, is they'll say, "I didn't know Dr. King smoked cigarettes," you know, and it's because saints are not supposed to smoke cigarettes. They're not supposed to be human beings. They're not supposed to, do the things that their parents do or other relatives and so forth. So we make saints or cardboard figures out of historical people. We downplay and diminish the things about them that we would regard as misbehaviors or even for which we would have outright ideological differences, right? I think about Edna Griffin, for example, and in the article that was written about her in one of the journals, sort of sharing her story, the fact that she was a communist was very much downplayed in the trial that she engaged in the lawsuit against Katz drugstore, because certainly at the time there were witch hunts going on. There was a lot of red baiting, and so we wanted to present her as this very demure, middle class, all-American person who was merely wanting to get something to drink at a lunch counter. And it was not coming from a place of ideology. It was not coming from a place of even anger, that she was doing the American thing, and that's what was going to win the lawsuit. And so often when we tell the stories of any of the people who were the heroes and heroes of history, too often we don't treat them as fully fledged human beings with complications and nuances and contradictions and so forth. And it does a disservice, again, to how kids could get engaged and interested in who these people were, but also they can't then see themselves or their relatives as being equally capable of making the kinds of substantial changes that occurred, because I'm not educated enough. I didn't go to Harvard. I don't have a PhD. I smoke cigarettes, you know, whatever all the things are that make you human, somehow I'm not capable, or even as a kid. I mean, we don't even talk so much about the young people who not only were the frontline activists in a lot of the what we call the civil rights movement, but they were the strategists, they were the thinkers, they were the ones who came up with the ideas that then led to the actions, right? It does a disservice to everyone to treat history in that way, and this particular history in particular.
Well, and I want to take one more moment to talk about Edna Griffin, but also Rosa Parks. Edna Griffin, of course, led that lawsuit against Katz Drugstore and the boycott of Katz Drugstore in Iowa. And what you were saying about her, I mean, she clearly was a very politically involved woman, and I could see the communism being a black mark against her and something that they wouldn't have wanted to talk about at that point. But that gives us some insight into the fact that she was dissatisfied with the status quo and wanted to make change. And Rosa Parks is someone else who we sort of get this very simplified image of a woman who was tired and fed up and said, I'm not going to take it anymore, which is all very admirable. But again, she was someone who had been dissatisfied for a long time and was planning. This was strategized, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And also they portray her as old, and she was only in her 40s at the time. But yes, absolutely. She had been a secretary of the local NAACP. She had been a person who helped to organize youth groups of the NAACP in Alabama, and so and had been to the Highlander Center, where she learned a lot about community organizing strategy, and connected with people from other parts of the country who were similarly concerned about what was happening in what some people refer to as the Jim Crow era, other people refer to as the neo-slavery era. And so you know, here we had the laws in 1896, the Plessy versus Ferguson Supreme Court decision that said separate but equal, and everybody knew that it was very much separate and not at all equal. But so we had people being treated as second-class citizens, and nobody wanted that. No African-American wanted that. And so, yes, for quite a number of years, she had been very, very active in organized groups to make change. And I think this is another piece I wanted to emphasize as well. We, historically in the U.S., hold individual people up as heroes and sheroes, disconnecting them from the other people in their community and in their world and the organizations that sustain their movement. And so she was part of an organization. And then once the boycott began, of course, then you had Joan Robinson, who said, okay, time to move, women. And it was the women of Montgomery that organized that boycott. You know, Dr. King gets a lot of the credit for it, but it was the people of Montgomery and the women of Montgomery that organized that. So it's a story seldom told. And people were ready. The other piece that often happens when we think about the civil rights movement or think about African-American activism, you know, these are just angry black people that one day just got mad and stood up and said, I'm not going to take it anymore, you know, as opposed to the fact that ever since about 1619, people said, this is not a good deal here. We're not being treated well here. We are human beings deserving of dignity. And how can we make that happen for ourselves? And other people observing that and saying, that doesn't look right. You know, that doesn't look Christian. It doesn't look democratic. It doesn't look fill in the blank. The ideals that we claim to hold in this country, what can we do to change this? It's been an ongoing conversation, an ongoing strategy, an ongoing organization to support this kind of work, as we still see today.
Now, I think anybody who has spent any time really digging into a certain aspect of history knows that there's so much more than just the simple story that gets told. And I can imagine a teacher sitting and listening to you and thinking, oh, I would love to talk to my students about all of those things, but I have all these other things that I also have to teach about within the school year. I don't think I have time to go deeper. What is your response to that?
And that is true. And especially in these times when testing is so important and so much what drives instruction. And so if you can't reduce it to a single answer that you can fill in a bubble on a test sheet, then it's not relevant, right? I think, though, especially starting in elementary school, it's about telling the truth of the story. So you can talk about, let's say, sit-ins, and without showing the Eyes on the Prize film, because you wouldn't do that with first graders. You wouldn't show them Eyes on the Prize. You wouldn't show the brutality. Right. You wouldn't scare the hell out of the kids, right? But you can say, what does it feel like to be bullied? First graders know that, right? What does it feel like to be bullied? What do you think it would feel like to want something that you deserve but have it denied you by a group of people who were acting out of a sense of conformity and fear rather than, you know, blah, blah. I mean, you wouldn't use that language, of course, of first graders. But so even if you are only going to do a King Holiday something or a Black History Month something, and you're doing it for little kids and you're worried about the complexity of it, there's still a way to get to distill it to the essential truth and teach that essential truth so that you build on that over time. So by the time you get to middle school, by the time you get to high school, by the time you get to a place where you can start to do project-based learning, for example, or kids are able to do their own research, et cetera, it's a foundation that's built on truth rather than on mythology and I won't say lies. Nobody sets out to tell a lie. But, things do grow into falsehoods that don't serve us well in understanding the history.
Do you feel like teachers have the resources, if they want to teach the civil rights movement in a little bit different way, with more nuance, a little more depth, are the textbooks out there? Are there resources they can turn to?
So you want me to sell my book?
Well, I mean, I know that your book was in large part a response to feeling like there wasn't stuff out there.
Exactly.
So you made something, but do you feel like that has changed? Are there other resources that have also come along, or are you kind of out there in the wilderness?
I would never say that our book is the greatest thing since sliced bread. I would never say that. So Teaching for Change, which was one of the publishers of the book, has a whole website that's devoted to civil rights teaching, just civil rights teaching. And then there are other components of the website that relate to other aspects of history. There's also the Zinn Education Project. It was named for Howard Zinn, who wrote People's History of the United States. It also has plenty of resources for teachers, a lot of primary sources that are very unusual primary sources. You're not often going to find in textbooks. Then there's the usual places like the archives and the National Archives and the Library of Congress for the teacher who has a bit of time in the summer to experiment with some curriculum design and the use of primary sources to structure a different way of telling the story. But there are lessons available in the Zinn Education site and the Teaching for Change website as good starters, good places to start.
I'm talking with Janice View. She's an associate professor at George Mason University, and she's also co-editor of the book Putting the Movement Back into Civil Rights Teaching. Also with me, Katie Swalwell, assistant professor of education at Iowa State University. And Katie, before we get to the break, I want to ask you, in putting together your course for the summer, and obviously this is geared for teachers and other members of the public, but this is information that you're hoping teachers will take back into the classroom with them. Do you find that there are good sources for this, or are you going back to primary sources?
Primary sources, I think, are always incredibly helpful. What we know is best practice with kids, even very young kids, to engage them with primary source analysis. I think the secondary sources can be really, really helpful for teachers to beef up their content knowledge, their background knowledge. So absolutely, that it's out there. You may have to dig a little bit for some of it, but it's absolutely out there. So one of my goals is to just make that as accessible to teachers as possible. I have a couple of students in the class this summer who their final project is to write a couple of children's books to make available to elementary school teachers, talking about some of these issues playing out in Iowa. You know, we do know that time is limited. There was just a big study done by the University of Northern Iowa called Social Studies, A Call to Action, that's available on the Department of Education's website, looking at the state of social studies teaching in Iowa. And if we're talking about the elementary level, we know that on average in Iowa, only 5.7% of the school year is spent on social studies. So 5.7% of any given school week is not a lot of time. So for teachers who feel really constrained and aren't able to get more time or have that district level support for social studies instruction, I would really encourage them to think about what is most important. If that is your limited time, what is most important to be talking about? What are, as Janice said, those questions that weigh on us today that we need help with making sense of and looking at the past in order to help make sense of the present?
Well, in a couple of minutes, we'll also talk about other parts of the curriculum as well, where some of the ideas that you've been talking about, Janice, can also be incorporated, or at least we should be aware of some biases in those curriculum. We'll talk about that a little bit more after the break. But Janice, I want to ask you, I mean, we've been focusing on history in this conversation as well. What about connecting the dots to what's going on right now in the United States? Do you think that that's something that is appropriate in the classroom and necessary in the classroom?
Absolutely. I mean, so social studies include civics, so that would be current events. And history ought to inform well, history does inform current events, right? And so the study of civics ought to include a study of history. They go hand in hand. I mean, I think it's sort of artificial to separate the two. And we can walk around with an ahistorical fog and pretend that this came out of nowhere. Here again, we have some angry Black people, you know, who are just rising out of nowhere because they don't know how to contain their emotions, as opposed to saying, this has historical roots. This goes back a ways. There's precedent. There's a reason why people are doing this. It's rational, right? It's not irrational. And so how do we understand what's happening today in light of what has come before and what's been unresolved before? I think it's absolutely essential to link the two disciplines, if we're going to call them separate disciplines, but certainly the understandings that come from exploring those issues.
There was actually, just to jump in here too, there was a recent study that just came out this week, the American National Election Studies, is just a really good reminder that the civil rights movement was really controversial as it was unfolding in those peak bookend years that Janice mentioned. So they said in 1964, 63% of Americans said the civil rights movement was moving too fast, 58% believed that Black people's actions hurt the cause, 57% said Black people were violent. So I think it's really important to remember that when we're looking at our current civil rights movement and the controversies around it and the complications and the nuances, that's normal. That has historic precedence. It's easy to look back at the past with rose-colored glasses, and we're trying to help teachers and students not do that.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me, Katie Swalwell, Assistant Professor of Education at Iowa State University, and Janice View, Associate Professor of Education at George Mason University and co-editor of Putting the Movement Back into Civil Rights Teaching. We're talking about the challenges of teaching about the civil rights movement. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the challenges of teaching about the civil rights movement, and that's going to be one of the conversations that's part of an event coming up on Friday at the African American History Museum of Iowa in Cedar Rapids. You can find out more about that event on our Twitter feed at IPR Talk and also on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. That event is open to the public, but RSVPs are welcome or necessary before you attend. With me this hour, Katie Swalwell, Assistant Professor of Education at Iowa State University, and Janice View, Associate Professor of Education at George Mason University, also co-editor of Putting the Movement Back into Civil Rights Teaching. She'll be speaking at the event on Friday. And I want to get to the phones as well. We welcome you to be a part of this conversation. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Rick is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Rick.
Rick,
hi. What would you like to talk about?
I'm not sure if I'm qualified to actually add much to this, but as far as the younger grades, as a background, I was wondering, a short documentary on the, I believe it was an Iowa teacher that did the brown eyes and blue eyes experiment back in the 50s or 60s, if that wouldn't be helpful for the elementary school kids. And then I'm reading a book called New England Bound by Wendy Warren. And it's about slavery in colonial times, and it starts back in the 1400s, actually. And for junior high and high school students, that's opening my eyes to things that I was never taught in the Iowa City public school system about slavery and just the treatment of other humans as chattel. So.
Rick, thanks a lot for your suggestions. And Janice, I'd love to get your response to that, because obviously if students want to go further, they can, but they may not have the ability to find the further to go to. So do you have some thoughts on that?
So I think I mentioned earlier the Teaching for Change website and the Zen Education Project website, and a lot of what there is accessible, at least for middle and high schoolers, might be a bit of a stretch for elementary school kids, but there are lots of children's books as well that are listed on the Teaching for Change website, that even picture books that either kids can read or can be read to them at the elementary level. So the materials they're never enough, you know, but there are some that exist. And I think his point about sort of stretching, well, he made two points. So one, you know, sort of stretching the boundaries to include a conversation about slavery and antecedents to the civil rights movement is an important part of giving context to what this was all about. The business about tapping into people's emotional understanding of what it means to be bullied or discriminated against or the target of violence. The brown eyes, blue eyes is a tricky one because there was a film actually that happened after the fact. I'm not sure if you've seen that, where they re-interviewed all those kids as adults to say, what was that like for you? What was the lasting memory and impression? What did you learn from that? It can be traumatizing, actually, sometimes. And so you have to be really delicate and careful about how you structure those kinds of experiential learning situations and what's age-appropriate. I mean, that's something that Katie and I have talked about a bit in some of our work together, you know, how you find what we're calling the sweet spot of what's age-appropriate in terms of how you tap emotions as part of teaching. But emotions are part of effective teaching. Right, having a personal connection to the material is an important part of retaining the information.
And I know that part of the idea behind that experiment, and we've actually interviewed the woman who created that experiment on Iowa Public Radio. But I mean, part of the idea was to help kids empathize, and maybe that was an extreme way to do it, and left some kids quite traumatized with either what they had done or what they had not done as part of that experiment. But empathy seems to be a really important key here, helping kids understand what it would be like. And that has to be really challenging. And I want to bring our next guest into the conversation as well, because she also is involved in educating teachers. Petra Lang is Special Programs Coordinator for the School of Education at Drake University. Hello, Petra.
Good morning.
And I want you to jump right in here, because when you're preparing teachers to teach about the civil rights movement and other things, here in Iowa, the majority of teachers you're working with, the majority of teachers in the classroom are white women. So when you're trying to teach kids empathy, do you have to start with teaching the teachers what to, or helping them understand their place in the world and the kind of white privilege that we experience?
Absolutely. The master's program that I'm a part of is the Culturally Responsive Leadership and Instruction Program, and that works specifically with Des Moines Public Schools. So we are developing a series of very specific classes that are for Des Moines Public Schools teachers. And one of the courses that just finished up last weekend is Cultural Proficiency 1. And in that, we ask teachers to do a lot of work in reflection so that they can be practitioners that understand how race or how all of the cultures that have shaped who they are as a person and how that impacts the interactions that they have with students as well. So with the history that we've been hearing about in this program, I, as an Iowan, born and raised, never received any of that until I took Katie Swalwell's class last summer. So that opened my eyes in huge ways to the context of the education that I received in Iowa. And so part of the work that we do in this program at Drake University is to help educators understand how that history has shaped policies and structures in our schools and how that would impact the behaviors of teachers, students, and administration, and then how that constructs culture. So one of our more loftier goals in this program is to help empower teachers to change the culture and the policies and the behavior in their building so that we can serve all students, which means we have to be reflective practitioners.
So how do you try to help teachers understand the privileged position that they may hold in society?
History is one of the places that we have gone to. One of our professors, Kevin Lamb, in the School of Ed, uses Race, the Power of Illusion. It's a PBS series, 3, that we use. So we look at the histories that impacted living conditions and like redlining and how our cities are built around how race has been interpreted by folks in those dominant cultures, and then how that directly impacts the schools that students go to. So when we're looking at how we serve our community of Des Moines, we can't ignore the history that has shaped our city. So that's one of the places that we go to with history. We do a lot of reading of theory. We do a lot of then application and reflection on specific curriculum documents. So teachers analyze the textbooks that they use. They use the district curriculum guides that are given to them. They look at their own syllabi and try to examine places where cultural bias has existed without anybody really looking at it or acknowledging it, and not for any malicious intent. It was just to not have that lens on when we're doing that work makes it really easy not to notice that things exist.
So you're looking well beyond the social studies curriculum to across the curriculum for that kind of bias.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to ask Janice to weigh in on that as well, because, of course, we've been focusing on teaching about the civil rights movement. But because of how our curriculum is put together, I mean, this permeates all subjects, right?
Oh, it does very much so. Language arts. There are even some ways that we try to think about how you can use science and math, you know, the STEM disciplines to understand history. You know, why not? I think what's really important to say, oftentimes if I'm in a setting where there are largely, white teachers who teach in largely white settings, and sometimes they'll say, well, why do we have to do this? You know, and it's because we live in a really big world where they're not just white people in the world, right? So it's not just teaching for the sake of teaching about civil rights content. It's for the sake of teaching about the larger world and preparing our young people for a larger world. And again, across a variety of disciplines. I mean, you know, you can look at, I won't bore you with some specific examples, but, you know, how can math and how can science and the arts, you know, help us understand historical content and people and the context of their world. It's a really, really engaging way of teaching, just teaching anything, but especially teaching history.
I can imagine that at this point in time with our polarized political culture at the moment and with current events and a lot of emotions running very high, that teachers might be a little terrified about bringing up the conversation about violence and Black Lives Matter and equality in 2016 into the classroom. I mean, Janice, what do you say to teachers who are scared?
Right. and it's a real thing. I would never want to sort of diminish the emotions of the teacher, and especially parents that want to protect their kids from this kind of content knowledge. I'm a parent too, and I've been a classroom teacher, so you know I understand from all of those perspectives. I guess the question is, what do we think we're doing when we take on the mantle of the educator and we're standing in front of a group of kids? Do we think that we are preserving the bubble because they will continue to live in the bubble for the rest of their lives and will never, ever have to confront any of these issues? Or are we, in fact, preparing them for their best selves and for a larger world? And so, therefore, how can we get past our own fear to know that kids are listening, right? Kids hear what's going on in the world. They hear the adults talking if they're reading the papers or the Internet or whatever. Or on Facebook. I mean, they know that something's happening, and they want help interpreting it. And that's the job of the adults in their world, is to help them understand and interpret it, even if we're afraid ourselves, even if we don't have answers ourselves, even if we are still struggling. Part of the education process is a dialogue and a communication and a negotiation around, well, how do we make sense of this? How can we work together to do some research to understand the antecedents of the situation? It's what education is, isn't it?
And I would say, too, Charity, that there's a really big difference between being a partisan teacher or taking a partisan stance and engaging with questions that are political, like little p political, in that they're problems that we have as a community, as a society, that we don't agree about. We might not agree about the root causes. We might not agree about what to do about it. But the question of what should we do, how should we live together, that's a really important question to ask in a democracy, especially in particular diverse democracy. So how should we live together? That is a political question, but it's certainly not a partisan question. So there's absolutely ways to engage students in thinking about these questions, looking at all sorts of different solutions, all sorts of different interpretations in ways that are not partisan, are not some kind of political indoctrination, but are political in the sense that they're engaging that question, how should we live together? What are the problems of our community and how can we solve them? And as Janice mentioned, math, science, the arts, history, language arts, all of those disciplines help us identify community problems and help us generate solutions, help us understand ourselves better.
And I'd also like to add, if I could,
yes.
One of the conversations that we had this weekend in cultural proficiency was that all teaching is political. Whether or not you think you're politically neutral, usually that means that you're just sustaining systems that have been in place for generations and then impacting our students in the same ways that they've been impacted for generations. And I also want to speak just really quickly to the notion of teaching in all white areas. And while Des Moines is blessed with the diversity that we have, I grew up in Adel, Iowa, where we didn't have any sense of really diversity that was honored or acknowledged. And I felt, when I started learning about race, that I learned about who I was as a white person. And I felt like I had been denied that conversation or that understanding of who I was because we didn't talk about it. So when we're talking about serving students, this includes all of our students to help us understand who we are and how history has shaped us.
And I want to share something that a teacher in Iowa shared not long ago on Facebook. And she is an African-American teacher. And she said, one of my summer school kids told me today that a black man with a, quote, missing bumper sticker drove down their street. And her cousin told her to be careful because the man would probably shoot or stab someone. This was a child in second grade. So, Petra, kids are bringing this into the classroom, too.
Absolutely, yeah. And if an instructor is able to create space where they feel safe to enter into that discomfort, amazing things can happen. And we also talked a little bit earlier about how there's pressure to teach to the test or make sure that we meet all of these things. But there are so many avenues that teachers can take to get to that knowledge and skills. And when we have that brave space to create or allow students to enter that discomfort, it really causes some engagement for them. And things become really relevant because life doesn't end when you enter a school. They're bringing that with them into our classrooms.
And Petra, I know you're also working outside of your classrooms. You are facilitating conversations about race in Des Moines with community members this month, right?
Yes, absolutely. And it's based on Dr. Swalwell's class. And what we've been doing is meeting every week in July, using anchor text, like one section to really focus all of our work and our discussion. And it's a multiracial group that has just come we've actually had such amazing conversations. We've become a very, very close community. And now we're looking at how do we extend this after the class is done. It was amazingly surprising and phenomenally rewarding.
Well, that is exciting. And keep us posted as you continue with that work as well. Okay. Petra, thank you so much for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Petra Lang, Special Programs Coordinator for the School of Education at Drake University. Katie Swalwell, thank you for being here today.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Katie Swalwell, Assistant Professor of Education at Iowa State University. This conversation was inspired by the online course she's teaching, Teaching and Learning Iowa History, Iowans and the Civil Rights Movement. And Janice View, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Janice View is an associate professor of education and transformative teaching at George Mason University. She is also the co-editor of Putting the Movement Back into Civil Rights Teaching. There'll be a new edition of that book released in January. And she is speaking at an event on Friday that is part of this online course, but it is open to the public on Friday at the African American History Museum of Iowa in Cedar Rapids. And she'll be speaking during that event. There will also be other speakers. And again, it's open to the public. You can find out more about that on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio, and also on our Twitter feed at IPR Talk. Talk of Iowa is produced at Iowa Public Radio News by Lindsay Moon, Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.